It's another Friday. It's another DC Signal to Noise. I'm John Harith with Jim Wiesmeyer from Pro Farmer and Natalie Zalaka from Farm Journal's Milk. And time to dig into the issues and topics at hand this week, including, well, of course, more China, more COVID aid, or maybe not more COVID aid, but more trouble for baseball. We'll get into that here in just a second. News on the federal milk marketing order, which hopefully Annalisa understands because Lord knows nobody else does. And Jim's got some news on the future of the filibuster and internet coming to the most remote parts of the country. So we'll cover all that in today's DC Signal to Noise. I'll start with, because it's near and dear to you and me, Jim, baseball. It's hitting home for me today as we record this on Friday. Now, COVID hitting my Cardinals. They're going to miss, well, one game postponed so far, but we know there's going to be several missed because of this now.
And the Nationals aren't going to play until Tuesday, you know, with the Mets, because they were supposed to play the Marlins. And now you've got a number of games have been postponed. And now the players are discussing having double headers, but they want an agreement. If they have double headers, they only go seven innings a game. Have you heard
which
that?
Which isn't unheard of. They, no, I guess, do it in the Corey minors. League. Corey League.
I don't think it's a good sign. I'm not comfortable that this season's going to, play out. But
I think the season. My prediction is the season has another week.
Yeah,
another week. That's it.
Yeah. I think it's you're just going to end up with too many games canceled and postponed for it to be sustainable in the coming days. And it's going to be time to pull the plug and figure out something else, which hurts me to my core. But I think I truly think that's what's going to happen. What about you, Jim?
Agree. And if baseball's having trouble, can you imagine football?
Oh, yeah. Football's unmanageable if baseball is in this condition. And NBA is another story because they do have somewhat of a protective bubble there. It'll be interesting to see how long they're able to contain coronavirus issues in that that bubble for the NBA. Hopefully they can do it.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's get on to what may qualify as good news for us this week. And that is, Jim, at least things didn't get worse with China this week.
No, they did not. And that is good news, actually. And they were a huge buyer of U.S. corn, their first purchase of U.S. rice. So for all you rice growers I know who listen, that's let's hope some more, more ahead. And one of Pro Farmer's China watchers is signaling to us, he accurately predicted last week to get ready for some big China buys, and we saw it this week. He's now saying we're going to see several million more tons of, China buys of U.S. corn, John.
And what is prompting that? Is that a price thing? Is that an interest in truly following through with phase one commitments? Is it trying to draw down some of the other tension that we're seeing on other issues with China? What's prompting their buys at this point?
Well, I think it's most of the reasons you said. The price is right, but the need is there in China, and their domestic corn prices are very high. And recall that when we interviewed Greg Dowd of the chief ag negotiator at the U.S. Trade Rep's office, his body language or voice on China fulfilling their tariff rate quotas, which I think is 7 million tons of corn, was very high. Now, whether or not that it'll be all 7 million tons of corn from the U.S. still remains to be seen, but I think that's the case. So I think it's all of the above, John.
And Annalisa, those big Chinese buys this week really provided some buoyancy amid what normally would have been a market downturn due to weather.
Yeah, we typically this time of year are in a weather market, and the weather this week has not been that great for either crop. So definitely helped there. And it was interesting to watch because, you know, over the past couple of weeks, as we've seen these big buys, the market has kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, ignored them up until this point. So that was good news for sure.
But normally you would have got even a more bounce from a speculative position on the biggest corn sale ever to China. So it could have been worse because it looks like we got not just a very big corn crop in the making, and ditto for soybeans. But Also, a number of traders and industry analysts are still negative on this China stuff because they're focusing on shipments, John. They're so in negative that they want to make sure that these things are shipped. So, I mean, that's an attitude out there.
Hey, Jimmy, you mentioned that yes, good, typical cynicism there.
Yes.
Jim, you mentioned last week on Signal to Noise that we should be watching this big policy meeting in China this week. Any big headlines out of that?
Well, the big headlines was that including Xi, you know, the leader, they know that they're also in a pickle on the economy, and they emphasize domestic marketing of their products. So they're taking a long term view that they're signaling that hey, we have enough people here, but they were more signaling to the Western world that they still want to trade and go back to the way it was before. So that's what I got out of it, John, is that they were not as belligerent as some of the hawks thought might be possible. So I guess that's good news, too.
That is indeed good news. Yeah, because you said there were some indications that there might be some push for Xi to take a harder stance with the U.S.
Yes. And in fact, some people, some China watchers here in the U.S. think that Xi has already overextended himself on this, overplayed his hand. So, again, maybe this is a correction that, long overdue.
Well, but given that, I mean, if there wasn't that push on Xi, does that mean that Xi maybe has a stronger hand within his party than some were speculating?
It could. Now, he will go out to the typical, 2 or 3 week, vacation. So we're not going to hear that much from Xi Jinping for the next few weeks. This is their summer, vacation. So, but you'll see the stories that he hasn't been seen for a while. That happens every year. That's why this policy, this big Politburo meeting before the vacation season is an important one to watch. And I noticed that they didn't rail against President Trump by name. So until as long as that lasts, I don't see the big concern that would result if they ever went official in any criticism of our president.
Well, we're talking China, and I really don't think this is tied into those other issues, but the timing is just odd, is these mystery seeds showing up across the country in people's mailboxes, most of them postmarked from China. What an odd occurrence, and I know there's been explanations that it's probably what they call a brushing scheme, trying to build up Amazon ratings, but I just can't see them sending that many. Now, there's over, I think, 1,200 packages reported now. I can't see them sending that many in a brushing scheme, but maybe they do.
Yeah, I can talk two sides on this one. On the one side, it is odd timing. And I think when it comes to China, they're so well planned. I'm a little nervous on that. But USDA's investigation, APHIS's, and I know they have the FBI looking into it right now. They're saying it's not bioterrorism, not for sure, but the investigations, I should have said, continue. And I know we in ProFarmer and other media outlets, I know Farm Journal has, that if any farmer gets a packet, they should notify their state ag director.
Well, and not just farmer, but these are going to folks in the general public as well. So if you get these seeds, don't open it, don't plant it, send it, contact your State Department of Agriculture or your county extension office.
Yeah. See, you never know on scams nowadays, and especially in this environment where you've got the economic downturn around the world. On AgriTalk, I mentioned, of course, I can't say the person's name, but a very good friend of mine late last week got scammed by Thailand, someone in Thailand, and the amount was unbelievable, $29,000. So any listener out there, and this person is a smart person. When I went through what happened to him, now he made some mistakes, some critical mistakes, but boy, you're in an environment now that on the internet, you better be very careful. They got into his checking account, unbelievable as it was.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and the other thing this raises, Annalisa, is it makes it incredibly transparent how somebody could introduce a biological attack on U.S. agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that has always been a concern of our industry. But I think, you know, despite all of the measures that we, you know, all of the biosecurity measures on farms and all of the things that we actively do, to see something this simple happen, to be completely honest, I thought when I first saw it on social media that it was some kind of like Facebook scheme thing, you know, that was just going viral. But no, I mean, it's really happened. It's really interesting. Jim, I would question whether or not APHIS would say whether they thought it was an act of bioterrorism or not, even if they did think that.
Well, they are saying it now, but I agree with you that that would have been the FBI's involved here. So I think you have a point. I think that they would want to make it crystal clear, even if it was, that it was indeed confirmed. And you would have seen the farm groups called in at many mm-hmm. different levels. I mean, they have a master plan of which how they would deal with something like that. I know that one. So there are steps in process that they have to take, and that doesn't happen overnight.
Well, and it hasn't been talked about much yet, but it does raise some concerns about the relationship between APHIS and Customs and Border Protection, because they should, in theory, be catching these things before yeah. they get delivered in the U.S. Most of them were mislabeled. And so these are the types of things that those two agencies are supposed to catch before they come into the United States.
For sure. Remember on A Signal to Noise when we had Representative Crawford? On
yes.
where he raised, that was his biggest concern. And so go back to that and just listen to some of his concerns. And in fact, we may want to have him on an upcoming program. So I think I'll make an effort to, get him back on to see, what his thoughts are on this.
Yeah, it does definitely hit back in the wheelhouse on that. And indeed. Well, let's move on, and maybe we can follow up with him next week on that, see what his schedule allows on that. So here we are, end of July. We have no new COVID aid package. Now, you said, Jim, it's probably going to be in the first couple of weeks of August, but we are hitting some critical timing here in that the, in particular, the jobless aid runs out at the end of the month, and also some eviction protections. But of course, what we're looking at mostly on here on Signal to Noise is assistance for agriculture. I know, Jim, you've been saying that first, second week of August, we're going to get something, but there were no signs of that at the end of this week that we're anywhere closer to any sort of an agreement.
Well, that's typical Washington, that, you know, you have to have all this drama before. And Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, came on and gave a presser right around 10:30-ish Eastern time today. And he said that the administration has offered the Democrats four different proposals, one of which would extend the $600 additional jobless benefits for a few months, but the Democrats rejected it. There were other initiatives. He basically said that he feels that the Democrats think they have all the leverage, and they're not even responding, you know, to the proposal. So that is odd. On it. So I wouldn't rule out something developing over the weekend, John, on maybe a escape valve here so they can continue to talk. But they are far apart under a number of major areas. And that's why I said last week, it looks like, this thing's going to take a couple of weeks to, get through some of these high hurdle topics. But boy, when you're just about to set off for a long summer recess, that will move a number of them to put pressure on the Democratic leadership in the House to, try to get some sort of compromise. And you have to look at the bigger issues, because agriculture is not going to get any aid until these sensitive areas like jobless, benefits, aid to states for the Republicans, some form of liability protection is handled, because it's all connected, John.
Well, let's talk about finding a solution, a compromise on agriculture, because even there we're seeing two significantly different approaches on the House side. You had the HEROES Act, which would have some very specific money put forward for agriculture, and an increase in the CCC authorization. On the Senate side, it's basically, here's $20 billion for USDA to decide what to do with it, which obviously won't fly with people like House Ag Committee Chairman Colin Peterson. So where are we likely to end up in the middle on that?
Well, I think it'll be tilted more than the middle toward the House side. You have a number of Republican senators who quietly favor the House approach. They don't like this open-endedness discretionary authority for USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue, and frankly, I don't blame them. The signal that you get, clearly, I mean, look at what we've seen from the ethanol lobbyists. They like the prescriptive language in the House version rather than the open-endedness in the Senate version, because frankly, history shows that the last year or so, USDA has not acted on ethanol aid language. So I think it's easier to get us, compromises in the ag package by mostly, not totally, favoring the House approach. And Senator Debbie Stabenow flat out said, you've got to have a significant increase in SNAP or food stamp funding, not only in the current benefits, but to increase them by 15%. And she has shown in the past that if she doesn't get what she wants, she can stop some things.
Well, and certainly there's a very valid argument to be made for that SNAP increase right now with the way the economy is. That just ties into some of the other provisions that are being put in this, what hopefully will be a compromise aid package.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see the market next week. If we don't have an announcement of either an extension of the $600 jobless benefits, because we had some horrible numbers come out for the second quarter of the gross domestic product, i.e. the economy. Can you imagine what they would have been had we not had those trillions of dollars that were announced to help temper some of the obvious pain here? And so this could build on itself. And as you said, this is affecting this lack of a compromise on the jobless benefits. It's affecting minimum 20 million people, if not up to 25 to 30 million people. That has to have an economic impact out there.
Yes, indeed. And to use a famous Republican phrase, it trickles down to landlords in particular right now. We're seeing that come to a head and some of those other financial pressures. So there is pressure on D.C. to get something done this week. Indeed. Remind me, Jim, it's $30 billion in the House that's in their plan. And then the Senate is claiming $33 billion, but
they're claiming $14 billion already there. $20 billion new funding, and then directing them to use the $14 billion. They all trillion, isn't it trillion? Yeah, no billion.
Billion. Yeah.
We go into these billions and trillions now that it's hard, but they're telling him to use what they've already given him. So I've had signal to noise type discussions behind the scenes of lobbyists and lawmakers trying to convince me that the Senate plan is more robust than I think it is. But and even the House plan, John, has $10 billion additional dollars, but doesn't mandate it. Again, that's discretionary up to USDA. Bottom line, no matter what the number is, John, there's going to be enough funding to implement agriculture needs out there. And you've already seen the CFAP, the way it's been run, they're not spending nearly as much money. Only 10% of what they thought for the specialty crops, and even the row crops or the non-specialty crops, as they call them, is behind. And I think that's a function of that more than a few farmers had actually sold 2019 inventory prior to January 15th. So this is why there's a big push to have a different type of approach program other than what USDA used for the CFAP program. And I think those people are correct.
Yeah, Annalisa, it's been a surprise, hasn't it, just how much CFAP money is left on the table at this point? I mean, I think they've spent somewhere just under, what, $7 billion of it so far?
Yeah, and you know, just to backtrack just a little bit, one of the things I wanted to point out, when you talk about the trickle-down effect of that $600 unemployment benefit, if you want to call it that, that really trickles down to employers, too, because, like, in our state, average unemployment with that $600 bonus is around $50,000 a year, and that has a significant impact on an employer's ability to hire new people who are currently on those benefits. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's complex and it's nuanced, and we have to look at it from all different sides, but I think leaving the employers out of that conversation is not wise.
Yeah, well, I agree, but there's a point there that's, I think, with the COVID resurrecting itself, I think that needs to be stabilized before we start retrenching this and I will call them benefits, because they were above and beyond what the jobless people were getting under the state unemployment. That was a talk about a stimulus, and it was. I'm not saying it wasn't needed. So I've changed my attitude on that because of the dastardly return of COVID-19 to a number of states, and in fact increasing, and it's just coming to the Midwest. You watch in another 2 to 3 weeks that the Midwest is going to be concerned about this.
Right, but then yep. When you think about essential workers that are putting their health at risk, that are not getting that $600 benefit, I mean, like I said, I think we could argue all sides of it, and it's not just a single, there's no one single solution here.
No.
Yeah, and I know in some states, and I believe it's the case here in Indiana, that if you are recalled to a job and refuse, you lose access to those unemployment benefits. So there are some safeguards in some states, but you're right. And that's been a point of the Republicans, particularly in the Senate, is how do we address this employment issue while still maintaining the support that the economy needs right now. Yeah. And you're right. It's a difficult way to difficult tightrope to walk because there are needs on both sides of that.
But you heard the Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, this week say, you know, he was really nervous relative to the outlook for COVID-19 and how it has such a linchpin to the U.S. economy. So again, I hope I'm wrong, but the best people I talk with, the most intelligent people, say this thing's going to linger as a big issue, even from a pharmaceutical or vaccine side, until the summer of next year, late spring, early summer. Because even if we did get a vaccine, by the time it gets to all the people, it's going to be, again, summer next year.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that we are going to be trying to find ways to pump money into this economy for some time, and then for some time trying to figure out ways to pay for that money we've pumped into the economy.
Yes. That's a later. Again, these numbers that we saw for the second quarter, when you talk about a signal, you know, just think if all these trillions of dollars were not paid out, what it would have been. So, and even in the market, the signals I'm trying to get from the market, the bond market is way low under the yields. And the equity markets are really, even though we're down this week, they've been rather robust. One of those two markets are going to be wrong, and the bond traders are usually correct. So they're signaling a little more trouble ahead.
All right, well, let's circle back to where we were with the CFAP payments. And Annalisa, as we were talking, you know, there's over half of that money that was allocated that still has not been paid out. Is your sense that it was that the need was overestimated, or that the construction of the CPAP program was too tight, particularly not including 2020 crops?
So I think there's several factors here. Let's not forget that farmers have only been paid 80% of their total what they qualified for. So there's 20% of the money that should be left on the table that farmers will receive payment for. I mean,
but it's like another $1.5 billion.
Right. But that's still to come. I think also when you look at, like, for example, dairy, there's roughly 20,000 producers who have enrolled in the program. We know that there's 35,000 dairy farmers licensed in the United States that are involved in some level of FSA program. So there's a lot of farmers that haven't signed up. And, you know, I had a conversation with John Newton this morning about some other things, and this came up when he and I were chatting. And
John Newton, the chief economist for American Farm Bureau Federation.
Yeah, sorry. He feels pretty strongly that FSA has not done a very good job in outreaching to producers, and that
really, you
know, something that we need to do more of. He specifically pointed out that when we, you know, first launched the margin protection program several years ago, FSA sent postcards to every producer. I have not received a postcard about the CFAT program at all. So I think, you know, there could be a point there. I also think, you know, we just, like you said, the 2020 crops aren't included. And I think that USDA might have underestimated how many producers had
had already marketed their crop outside the effective window.
We're good marketers. Yeah. They underestimated how many better marketers there were, and they're rewarding people who did not take the signals from the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Bottom line, I go back to at least my reporting right after the CFAP was announced. They had a lot of problems on it, and I think that's evidenced now. Not only the program was flawed to begin with, complex, only dealt with what, one quarter, you know, and now this one, maybe it's only going to deal with another quarter, you know. I just think that it was a failed program, and it's time to regroup.
Any signs that USDA is doing that?
They're going to have to be directed prescriptively, like in the House.
Oh, you're saying the House version.
The House version takes care of a lot of the apparent issues in the CFAP, and I think that's meritorious on the House bill language. The Senate, again, just throwing up their hands and then saying, okay, USDA, continue it. And I know on AgriTalk, Chip had Senator Pat Roberts on, and he said, well, to consult with the House and Senate Agriculture Committee, it's like doing a farm bill in 2 weeks. Well, that's what it runs down to anyway.
Yeah.
You know, Senator, by the time you get down to the conference, a conference usually lasts, about, before they do their homework, about 2 weeks when all the decisions are made. I just think that this has to be altered to get Congress more involved. And that's what House Ag Committee Chairman Colin Peterson has been saying, that it's tilted far too much from an executive branch that has to scramble you know, to get it out, which is part of the problems that Annalisa said, is they couldn't do their communication skills the way they usually did, because they were having to make so many just complex decisions on something that they weren't used to. And given, to be fair to USDA, they were thrown money and said, okay, come up with the program. I want to get it out of the top economist shop at USDA and back into Congress where it belongs.
Indeed. All right. Well, while we're talking COVID-19, and I think we've already mentioned some of this, it just feels like there was a shift this week. You know, I've already talked about how baseball has been impacted and is likely going to be impacted even further in the coming days. And, you know, we've talked about some of these other issues, and I got a signal at my house this week about how experts are warning that this is shifting more to the Midwest now, which obviously impacts agriculture more directly. But I got a signal at my house this week. Our school district, not quite a month ago, had sent out a notice that we were going to be coming back to the classroom as scheduled in the fall. They were going to make an accommodation for those who wanted to do distance learning, but that the majority was going to come back to the classroom. Well, just yesterday, got a message that they have now changed their minds, and we're going to be doing virtual learning at least through the first quarter. And I know our school district is not alone. So there are strong signals going that the landscape of the coronavirus, particularly in the Midwest, is shifting right now.
Yes. And and you know, the last few weeks I told you in mid-August I signed up to fly to Wisconsin, you know, Wisconsin Dells, to give my first on-site speech, as well a number of other people were going to be there. And just 2 days ago, they called and said, we have now decided to do it online only. And I think that was the similar type of signals, John, that you just mentioned that they got. I'm frankly happy that I wished I wouldn't have signed up to fly there. Now I'm glad that I'm not going, that I'll do anything on a web on online like we're doing now. And I won't agree to do any person thing probably until summer of next year.
Yeah, Ed, we're seeing a lot of things take on that kind of a timetable right now. While we're here, though, and since you mentioned it, Jim, let's do a little commercial for some things that you and I are going to be involved in the coming weeks. First of all, Crop Tour. Crop Tour for Pro Farmer is going to go on, though it is going to be different, as most things are in this year. They are limiting the number of scouts. They're limiting the number of scouts in a car to just two. But we are going to have Crop Tour, and I think there is a big benefit in these changes to the audience listening and watching now to this podcast, in that it used to be you had to get a ticket, first of all, which those were sometimes hard to come by, and then go to one of the nightly meetings on location on the Crop Tour. Well, we're not doing those nightly meetings anymore, again, because of the pandemic. What we're doing instead is a nightly meeting that is going to be streamed live. If you go to Farm Journal Field Days, .com, you can sign up not only for Crop Tour, but also Farm Journal Field Days, which we'll get to in a minute. But you can tune in 7 o'clock Central every night and see Chip and Brian Grady and Jeff Wilson and Clinton Griffiths and Tyne Morgan all talk about the results from that day scouting. We'll also get some scouts in there to talk about it as well. Everyone has immediate access to those Crop Tour numbers every night this year, rather than those who are able to get a ticket into one of those events.
Pro Farmer has said that there's still space for scouts on the Crop Tour. So if anyone's interested, email editors@profarmer.com. And for another website you can go to other than, you know, Farm Journals, you can participate, as John said, in those virtual meetings that I think are going to be great. No matter where you live, and to register for free, you can go to profarmer.com/register. So you have several different ways that you can, get involved here, which I think is always good, because this is going to be very instructive to even more farmers and ranchers of how this Crop Tour operates.
Yeah, and again, it's the first on-the-ground look where they actually peel back ears of corn and get into fields to see and quantify that crop. And again, it's free. Even though you have to register for it, it is free whether you're a Pro Farmer member or not. And then following that is going to be Field Days. It's a virtual farm show covering machinery, technology, policy, and that's where you and I come in, Jim. We're going to be doing a seminar on Farm Journal Field Days, looking forward to the November election. So be sure to register for that. That, again, is free, and it's all going to wrap up then with the Farm On concert, which is free, although we do encourage people to donate to 4-H as part of that. That's going to be August 27th at 7 p.m. And again, just register and you'll sign up and get the location to go and watch that and make your donation to 4-H. Headlined by Lee Bryce. We've also got Justin Moore and several others that are in the final stages of being confirmed. If you go back to last week's Signal to Noise, we gave away one of them that we're working with that we don't quite have all the way there yet, but I think she's going to come together. So if you want that sneak peek, go back and listen to last week's Signal to Noise. But all that's coming up, farmjournalfielddays.com or profarmer.com, and you can get all the information. All right. And
what John just said, we're not giving in, we're giving back, okay?
That's right.
A number of areas, and that's the plus side of having to be cloistered in your homes or whatever, that you can expand your audience, actually, and do some other things creatively, and that's what's so good about Americans, the entrepreneurship involved.
Yeah, and not done with the commercial yet, because I'm going to talk about how excited the folks at Pro Farmer are about how we're doing that nightly meeting this year. Because if you go to agweb.com, Chip wrote a nice column about this and how from the very beginning, when Pro Farmer took over this Crop Tour, they wanted to make the information that was available to traders, make that available to farmers on an even and immediate basis. And doing these nightly meetings, streaming them live, actually finally fully realizes that dream. And so I think you'll probably, even if they go back to those nightly meetings, I think you'll see something like this continue because it makes that information so freely available and immediately available and puts farmers on the same foothold as traders who have their research done. All right, now I'm done with the commercial. Let's get on with some of the other issues going on. And all right, Annalisa, we're turning to you on this one because nobody understands the federal milk marketing order. You had an extended conversation today with John Newton at the American Farm Bureau Federation, who was mentioned earlier, their chief economist. They are pushing some changes in the federal milk marketing order. So go. Hopefully you understand it better than we do.
So I barely understand it better than you do. The federal milk marketing order has been in place for more than 80 years. The last time we made a significant change, I guess we should say that the last time we made a very significant change, which is what Farm Bureau is talking about, was in the 1950s. We did in the 2018 Farm Bill change the Class 1 formula for milk pricing, which did modify that federal order, but not to the extent of what they're proposing. So Farm Bureau is saying that they really want farmers to have a seat at the table when it comes to voting on how milk is priced in the United States. Currently, there's something called block voting where cooperatives count as one farmer. So if you're a member of, for example, DFA, you don't get to individually vote on anything for the order. Your cooperative does that for you. So they would like to change that. They would also like to change some of the price discovery mechanisms and some of the incentives for producers. Like right now, there's a $3 hundredweight incentive for processors to make cheese, which is part of how we got into the situation that we were in during COVID. That's one of the reasons that plants are not very diversified, because they make more money when they're making cheese than when they're processing other things. So some interesting changes. There's a lot of controversy when they first, they first debuted these changes in October. Before their members had voted to make them policy, there was a lot of concern about unintended consequences. I think, that the team at Farm Bureau is very smart in releasing, their set of policy that they voted on in January. They released it officially this week. I think coming off of, the extreme volatility and the unintended consequences that we witnessed from the 2018 Farm Bill changes in June and July, I think it's really smart that they're releasing this information now, because there's a lot of incentive and a lot of desire on the part of farmers to take another look at how this is working, because it's not. I don't think that there's a dairy producer in the United States that would tell you they're happy with how their milk is priced. But it'll be interesting because it requires congressional hearing to get changed or an amendment. They could amend the act in an appropriations bill or something like that. Jim would have to give us more specifics on which types of bills they could tag an amendment to this on. But to reopen the act, it would require congressional hearing. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
So it sounds like they're setting the stage now for a open debate on it in the next Congress.
Yeah.
So, Jim, how likely is it that something like that could get through?
Well, yeah, you mean in a new Congress?
Yeah, and I guess
that bridges us into a whole new area as well. I think that number one, for the Farm Bureau, they're grassroots oriented from all their state offices. So again, I do applaud them for seeking what tends to be, to me, market oriented changes. You could always go into a trial approach. And if there are unintended consequences, and there always are, then you can get a timeline with which they can deal with those. As far as getting them out of Congress, and I do think this is such a major change that Congress, should approve it. If it's next year, then that all depends. It gets us into the big bailiwick of the elections, but things could dramatically change very quickly, John, if the Democrats control the White House, House, and the Senate, because former President Barack Obama, during the eulogy address that he gave for Representative Lewis this week, more than pushed for the end of the filibuster. And he actually even called prior use of the filibuster, that's the 60 votes needed to stop debate, that both parties have used in the past when they're in the minority to stop things that they don't like. Obama even used the term it was racist in the past because for years it stopped race relations language from getting through. Bottom line, if the filibuster is done away with and the Democrats control the board, White House, House, and Senate, you could have substantial changes to a potpourri of issues faster than anyone realizes. Now, when we discussed this on AgriTalk, Pam Johnson said, well, we've had a lot of changes and, you know, the last 2 years, meaning Congress, but I think what she was getting at is at the White House. But this would codify these changes if you do away with the filibuster. And there's a significant difference between executive announcements that can be changed if you have a new president, as opposed to codifying them from Congress. I think this was one of the more important stories this week, believe it or not, of the increased odds that we could end the filibuster under those scenarios. It could have substantial changes because then the Democrats could get into their agenda far easier than they otherwise could.
Yeah, indeed. And something else that more directly could impact this particular notion of change in dairy policy would be you very likely could end up with Colin Peterson as chair of the House Ag Committee, which he is now, and would continue to be likely, more than likely, if he survives his election, and Debbie Stabenow, chair of the Senate Ag Committee. That would certainly, I think, open up the possibility to relooking at dairy policy.
Absolutely.
All right. Last thing before we wrap up today, Jim, your good news item for this morning on AgriTalk is what the quickly approaching private sector addressing of broadband internet for the most remote parts of America.
Yeah, it was very good news when I saw it because Amazon.com has a division, tech division, and they got a boost this week from the FCC that approved Amazon's $10 billion plan to put a little over 3,000 what they call low Earth orbit satellites that would compete with a similar project called Starlink by SpaceX. But the bottom line is this is the private sector, which I always prefer under a government solution, to provide a high speed, not just internet, high speed internet to unserved and underserved areas. And boy, is rural America underserved in this area. And I think that was just a shot of good news to get Amazon to be in competition with that Starlink project. And it'll probably succeed. Rather than the millions, if not billions of dollars that have gone out from both Republican administrations with Trump and the Obama that put a lot of money into the Midwest and high-speed internet, only to see their states divert that money for other purposes. Well, this won't be the case if the private sector gets involved.
Yeah, and a number of those microsatellites are already up in space. I haven't seen the latest on the timetable for that, but I know both projects are moving forward rather rapidly, so hopefully we will see.
Yeah, they don't know the word slow.
Okay. Yeah.
It's not in their vocabulary.
But I don't know that we'll get two-day delivery on these.
No, we won't get it. And when I wrote this, I got several emails from farmers saying, what will it cost? What will it cost? And the only thing I could answer back was, it won't be free.
Well, included with Prime, right?
Oh, they'll find an angle. But
again, they will.
I just think the significance of the signal of this, John and Annalisa, that it's just not agriculture uses. It's telemedicine and all the other stuff that rural country definitely needs. And it would not further divide the urban-rural spread, you know. So this is a biggie. This is a megatrend change that I think is in the making, and I just don't think it got the media coverage that it deserved.
All right. Well, with that, I've got to go talk with Chip, so let's get to it. Where are we watching for Signal this coming week, Jim?
Oh, this will be the continued negotiations, and at least they're talking between the White House, the Senate Republicans, and the Democrats in Congress. That's the big issue that I'll be looking at.
All right, Annalisa.
Same. Coronavirus aid. I think if you're watching anything else, you're not paying attention.
Well, I'm watching to see if baseball continues beyond next week. That's where I'm watching for signal next week. All right. Well, thank you both. That's Jim Wiesmeyer from Pro Farmer, Annalise Alaka from Farm Journal's Milk, and I'm John Harris. Thanks for joining us this week on DC Signal to Noise.